playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. It was politics as pantomime again in London, and yet more humiliation for British Prime Minister Theresa May. At the start of the week, she cut a forlorn figure as she faced a crucial vote in the Commons on the withdrawal agreement, a vote which nobody believed she was going to win. On Monday, they jeered and sneered at her in Parliament. She accepted the inevitable and pulled the meaningful vote. She then set off on a frantic whistle-stop tour of European capitals to try to get some improvements on the Irish backstop, the crux of the problem. But no joy there. The deal is the deal, she was told. And then, just when she thought it couldn't get any worse, high drama on Wednesday. The hardline Brexiteers finally got the 48 signatories they'd been banging on about for weeks and put down a motion of no confidence in her leadership. The story broke on Morning Ireland.
And we're going live to Downing Street.
There will now be a vote of confidence in my leadership of the Conservative Party. I will contest that vote with everything I've got. A change of leadership in the Conservative Party now will put our country's future at risk and create uncertainty when we can least afford it. I have devoted myself unsparingly to these tasks ever since I became Prime Minister, and I stand ready to finish the job.
Tory MP Anna Soubry was outraged and apologised to the Irish people for her party's behaviour.
I'm acutely appalled by what is going on and I can only apologise.
But in relation to Theresa May, you sound shocked. You say you're embarrassed at this point in time. But wasn't it only a matter of time before these signatures were gathered and this motion moved? I mean, you know the government was defeated three times in 1 hour last week. On Monday, she pulled the vote because of the scale of the loss that she was expecting.
I don't disagree with you. But notwithstanding all of that, as I say, the most irresponsible thing to do is change the leader. Actually, it won't change anything. It won't make the Brexit reality go away. In fact, the danger is you'll get, God help us, someone like Boris Johnson, the most inept foreign secretary we've ever had in the United Kingdom. The danger is that he could become the next prime minister. And as I say, God help us in that event.
He'll deliver what the people of the UK voted for.
No, he will not. Because he can't. This is the problem with all these wretched people, is that they can't face up to the Brexit reality. The reality is, if you want frictionless trade, which is good for British business, if you want to avoid the hard border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, then the only way to do that is to be closely aligned to the European Union. Now, if you do that, then you become a rule taker, not a rule maker. I don't have a problem with that. I've been arguing it for the last 2 years, because it's the price worth paying for peace in Northern Ireland, and it's the price worth paying because it's the best thing for British business.
Tory MP Anna Soubry with Audrey Carvel. In the event, the coup failed and Theresa May won the secret ballot, 200 to 117. But at what cost? Over a third of her party voted no confidence in her, and she won't lead her party into the next general election.
This has been a long and challenging day, but at the end of it, I'm pleased to have received the backing of my colleagues in tonight's ballot. Whilst I'm grateful for that support, a significant number of colleagues did cast a vote against me, and I've listened to what they said. Following this ballot, we now need to get on with the job of delivering Brexit for the British people and building a better future for this country. A Brexit that delivers on the vote that people gave, that brings back control of our money, our borders and our laws, that protects jobs, security and the union, that brings the country back together rather than entrenching division. That must start here in Westminster, with politicians on all sides coming together and acting in the national interest. For my part, I've heard what the House of Commons said about the Northern Ireland backstop. And when I go to the European Council tomorrow, I will be seeking legal and political assurances that will assuage the concerns that members of Parliament have on that issue.
Andrew Bridgen is a hardcore Brexiteer. He spoke with Barry Lenehan at Westminster and revealed the scale of opposition within the Conservative Party to the Prime Minister and her withdrawal agreement.
I'm deeply disappointed. I think the Parliamentary Conservative Party had an opportunity last night to reset the dial, go to Brussels with a new Prime Minister, ask for a better deal, And I think we just kicked the can down the road. And unfortunately, I think the government, we're running out of road to kick the can down.
What do you mean by that?
Well, last night, because we didn't grasp the nettle and deal with the issue, nothing has changed, to quote the Prime Minister's words. The Prime Minister still doesn't have a majority to get her withdrawal agreement through.
Is this not a vindication of her deal, though, if the majority of your parliamentary party are supporting her?
That won't get individuals who oppose the withdrawal agreement on board. It won't get her the majority. It doesn't get the DUP back on board to guarantee that we've got a majority in the House of Commons. The Prime Minister had to admit last night that she's not the person to lead the Conservative Party into the next general election in 2022. But without a parliamentary majority, we're very vulnerable to a vote of no confidence in the government. And even if every Conservative MP backs the government, without the DUP, we're not guaranteed to win it, which means we could be heading to a general election very, very soon.
With still no agreement on how to leave the European Union and Theresa May's attempts for legal and political assurances from the EU falling on deaf ears, everything, as they say, is as clear as mud. Over on the Today Show, Sean O'Rourke spoke with veteran Westminster watcher Gavin Esler.
You're somebody who's come out very strongly against Brexit, but do you think the deal that Mrs. May has negotiated has any prospect at all of getting through Parliament with or without legally binding or other kinds of assurances?
Absolutely none. I mean, this is really pantomime season in London, and the Prime Minister is in office, but she has not got any power. She lacks authority. It's a kind of zombie Prime Minister with what I think now is a zombie Brexit deal. There is just within Parliament, there is no majority for any kind of deal that she is likely to come up with. And, you know, I'm sure Mr. Varadkar will give her tea and sympathy, but I've just come back from Brussels. And the mood there is, we feel so sorry for the British Prime Minister. You know, that wasn't how they felt about Mrs. Thatcher. They might not have liked her, but they didn't feel sorry for her. It wasn't how they felt about any British Prime Minister in recent years. And so I think the Prime Minister has been told to get on with it. For 25 years, the Conservative Party has been having a conversation with itself about what it is, and they still can't make up their minds completely and can't unify their own party. They certainly can't unify the Parliament or the country.
Well, be that as it may, what are the alternatives?
Just looking at what's there, I mean, it's all very well to say, you know, the EU is refusing to bend, but surely it is in the EU's interest, every bit as much as it is in the British interest, to hammer out some sort of a deal to avoid the so-called hard Brexit. Looking at Ian Duncan-Smith, the former Tory leader on Sky earlier on, he said, it has to be clear, it has to be binding. This is the reassurance. The EU has a decision to make. If you want to do a deal, you better damn well step up to the plate.
Well, I know, but I mean, they have been saying this for years. David Davis, the guy who was in charge of Brexit, said yesterday, now is the moment to seize control, deliver our own destiny. We can't continually kick the can down the road. It's not a valid strategy. We mustn't shirk from tough decisions. It's the same old cliches without any substance. Parliament has not voted on whether there should be a second referendum. If you think a second referendum is divisive, you can imagine what a minority government with a zombie prime minister forcing through a no deal to end up on WTO terms. You can imagine what that will do to this country. It will be disastrous, and there's certainly no majority in Parliament for that. I think in the end it probably will come to a second referendum. We've had Theresa May face the vote in 2016. Certain members of her own party changed their mind in 2018. Within 2 years, they managed to have a politician's vote. It's okay for the Conservative Party to change their minds, but not the British people. Come on.
Former BBC Newsnight presenter Gavin Esler, heard on the Today Show. Gerry Adams is no stranger to the cut and thrust of British politics, not to mention the down and dirty negotiations and compromises necessary when both sides are staring into the abyss. In a new departure, he's co-written a cookbook with Republican foodies Ted Howell and Porrick Wilson. It's called The Negotiator's Cookbook, and it gives the inside story of how Sinn Féin negotiators sustained their stamina and energy during the long drawn-out talks leading up to the Irish peace process. The British, he said, were reluctant to feed them. Its own negotiating team preferred to graze on the occasional pizza or Chinese takeaway.
It's funny, talking to you this morning, there's a lot of big, heavy things going on, but there's also this business of the negotiator's cookbook where you say that the British were terrible at feeding negotiators down through the years, be they unionist or Republican.
Yeah, well, first of all, you go to London for talks, so you're on an early flight. You could be there at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. You'd be starving. I know we have an ancestral hunger, and I made that point to Tony Blair in the past. And Martin McGuinness used to always be a wee bit embarrassed how I used to harp on with their failure to provide food. And there was a little woman from Monaghan was the main sort of tea lady.
Yes, and in Downing Street.
Yeah, she was always embarrassed because she gave us what she called an Englishman's cup of tea. And my granny used to say that was a cup of tea, which was just a cup of tea. Yeah. There was no sort of flour, no potato bread, no cake or no buns with it.
And so that's how the Negotiator's Cookbook came about.
So the two lads would have brought in some soup, maybe a bit of bread, a bit of wheaten bread. And then that transpired, they would have brought in some pasta, some rice dishes. And then we ended up with practically a diner's club. Most of this was in room 316 at Stormont or in Martin McGuinness's office at Stormont Castle. So we became self-sufficient and we ended up, you know, an odd Irish government minister would have
come in for
dined, you know, some unionists, certainly government officials. And what I then did was I asked Padraig and Ted, would they give me the recipes? And I put those recipes
into your book
together, and I'd give a wee short history of what we got up to. I mean, this is a real cookbook.
Yes. At the back of the book are alternative names for the book, including the peas process.
I got a flood of suggestions into my Twitter account, and it included the frying column, come out you rack of lambs, turkey à la,
yes,
long quiche.
Yes.
These were all suggestions that were made.
Whenever I tell people Gerry Adams is going to be on the radio, there's a lot of gnashing of teeth. And people say, how can you talk to Gerry Adams about a cookbook when he had this past that is, to some people, unforgivable and troublesome and difficult? And they're probably kind words. What do you say to people who are furious that we're talking this morning? They're still furious.
They need to get a life. They need to catch themselves on. I'm elected. I'm very honoured to be elected by the people of Louth and East Meath. I was elected for decades by the people of West Belfast. People don't need to agree with me any more than I need to agree with them. But what I think we all should have learnt, and sometimes I wonder if we really do. There were times when you could not have interviewed me. Now, what good purpose was served by that? It's only when we get round to the primacy of talking, of listening, of disagreeing, of arguing. And I noticed when we started to talk to the unions, and this was a time when we were banned from the airwaves, when we were banned from municipal and public buildings, when Sinn Féin was treated like pariahs. When we were talking to unions very, very quietly on the side, one of the things that I noticed was that even though we were arguing, we kept coming back to talk. And that's when I knew there was a shift.
Gerry Adams with Ryan Tuberty on Wednesday. Meanwhile, back in Leinster House, RTE's political correspondent Micheál Lehane was keeping a close eye on events.
After weeks in which nobody noticed them happening, the confidence and supply talks finally concluded.
I think everyone can see the whole thing is a sham. Mm-hmm. It's shoddy from start to finish.
Right.
And deeply unpalatable.
What do you think Fianna Fáil should have done instead?
What? I was talking about Gerry's cookbook interview on Ryan Tuberty the other day.
What?
I think Ryan's questions were unfair and hurtful.
Oh.
I mean, look at the cut of him. What would he know about a lasagna, yeah?
Later, I met Shane Ross.
Well, I don't think the British people will vote out. I think Mr Cameron has given great assurances and has done a very...
Sorry, Minister, when did you last see the news?
Oh, right. I'm far too busy working on my proposed legislation on road safety.
Oh.
I am going to make it compulsory for children over 5 months...
What?
..to have a licence for bicycles, tricycles and toy prams that they might get at Christmas. Just because you're a baby does not mean the government will not figure out a way of getting money out of you.
Finally, this week was the news that Jackie Healy-Raid Jr. will run in next year's local elections.
I tell you now, I'm a member of the younger generation.
Yes.
And I'm going to be a voice for young Kerry people and the big issues that to face them.
Like climate change?
No, like keeping the dance halls open.
Oh.
Reducing the cost of the high nellies.
What?
And increasing the number of jams in the local forge.
What age are you exactly?
I tell you now, I'm like a wailing calf, and I'm asking the people of Kerry to let me out into the field among the thistles in the local elections.
Micheál Lehane, wishing I'd studied something else in college and lived abroad by now. RTÉ News.
From Callan's Kicks last night.
We're walking in the air. We're
Oh, Christmas wouldn't be Christmas without the Palestrina Choir, conducted by Blonid Murphy, heard on Today with Sean O'Rourke. It's now time to go over to Lovely Land and what's become known as the Miracle of Mullinjachta, in honour of the football team from the half parish of Mullinjachta in North Longford, who beat the favourite superstars Kilmacud Crokes by 2 points in the Leinster senior final last Sunday in O'Connor Park in Tullamore. RTE's GAA commentators Brian Carthy and Bernard Flynn were there.
Mullinjachta coming forward and the ball fisted back, and that was most assuredly the penalty for Mullinjachta. He was grounded in the small rectangle. Penalty for the Longford champion.
Does it get any bigger from this from someone from Mullinjachta? Just 1 minute, 50 seconds left, 2 points in a penalty. They couldn't have dreamt about it last night, Brian.
St. Columbus, Mullinjachta have a penalty against Kilmacud Crokes. It's likely Gary Rogers will take the penalty.
Gary Rogers is the man.
He is standing still. A goal will put Mullinjachta ahead. Short to the ball. A goal for Mullinjachta, and the lead, the Dublin champions, by a single. Referee blows the full-time whistle and Mullinjachta have defied the odds.
Just have a look at those joyous scenes. It rips and shreds the whole argument of money and resources and everything. 400 people in the community, 150, 60 members. Look at the supporters trying to get out on to meet the players on the field, family and friends. It is incredible. Kilmacud are in disbelief.
The bonfires were lit in Mullinjachta, home to just 447 people, to celebrate the biggest upset in GAA club history. Darren Frehill spoke with coach Dan McGilligott. He has an interesting backstory. A Kerry man who ended up in the Midlands after he married local Mullinjachta woman Bernie. The rest is history.
It's incredible, really. You spend your lifetime listening to other people's fairy tales and stories and dreaming, you know, that someday it could happen. But it'll take a while for reality to set in, Dan. It's just everybody really is in dreamland.
Dan, I know you're very involved in the coaching side, but you're also father to a couple of players. Just how many of your lads were involved in the squad yesterday?
5 lads total involved in the panel, Dan. The 2 actually played yesterday. But within the panel, there's actually 6 sets of others. Like one big family. That's the reality in Mullinjachta here.
Someone has told me down there that you're the blow-in into this setup, and that the football comes from your wife, Bernie. Is that true?
That's right. Yeah, we'll have to give her credit. Hey, look, I suppose the young lads around here, you know, they have been reared on stories of the past, you know, that herald deeds of the past. It was in the 40s and 50s that success came to Mullinjachta previously, and the past generations, and certainly Bernie's father and uncles would have been part of that success in the 40s and 50s. The young people had to go back to that era to hear of, it was no different than hearing stories of John McCool and Satanta and all those heroes of the past. But now all the young people in Mullinjachta, they have a new breed of heroes, new heroes to look up to, and it's their walking among them. Well, there mightn't be too many walking today, Darren, but they're just, see them every day, and it's their heroes are there in person now, and that's massive, massive boost for future generations in the parish.
From Monday's Morning Ireland, well, just a few miles from the Cavan-Longford border where all those celebrations took place, Drive Time reporter John Cook hopped on the local nighttime rural bus service from Granard to Longford town. You may remember Transport Minister Shane Ross announced the pilot project last summer to tackle social isolation, and the service is being reviewed this month to see whether it's worth the €450,000 the scheme has cost. Well, as John found out, there's a lot of interest in the nighttime service ever since the changes in road traffic legislation came into effect.
What's your name, sir?
Johnny. They should run it all week. These extra buses later in the evening, all week. Because it would suit a lot of people if it was running later. Shane Ross has left it that nobody can take a drink now, so I think he should subsidise it during the whole week.
How did you feel about the drink driving laws changing?
I think it was absolutely stupid, because people, when they come to pension age like me, should be allowed to have their couple of pints and meet people in the pub and be able to drive home.
But it's not okay to drink and drive, is it?
No, we don't cause any trouble. It's the people that's coming out of the clubs at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning that's killing each other.
I suppose, with all due respect, people over 60s cause fatal accidents too.
If you look at the statistics, very few people over 60 has caused any trouble. We only go to the pub 3 miles from my house, and we'll definitely be entitled to have two or three drinks and go home.
It's not going to happen though, is it? Because you can see the way the drink driving laws are gone. Will this bus service, will it make up for it in some way, or will it help?
We're running during the week as well. The two nights is not good enough.
How are you doing, guys?
Not too bad.
Not nearly.
That's a daughter of mine, that's a son of mine, and that's his friend.
Yeah, yeah.
This man here just passed his life and test today, so it's a little celebratory.
It's your son.
This is my son here, yeah.
What's his name?
That's Michael.
Michael, congratulations. How old are you, Michael?
I'm 19 now.
You're bringing the family out to Longford Town.
It's only something small. We'd probably go to Luigi's and maybe eat a bit of grub there or something like that. And
what's life like in Granard for a 19-year-old? So,
well, it's f*** all to do unless you have a licence, to be honest. You can drive places and nothing to worry about.
It's quiet.
Yeah, it would be, yeah. Like, there wouldn't be much of a social life in it. You'd have to go places. More than likely the Hideaway Bar, Clonclivet, or sometimes into the Spiral 3 here in Longford.
Okay. And how would you travel?
This bus here, or sometimes if I'm going to the local, get mum and dad drop me.
Has this made a big difference, do you think, that it's only going since the summer now?
It has made a huge difference now. It stops a lot of arguments of who's to sit turn, is it to drive, and who's to collect who, and that's around it.
Would you say, there was a man talking to me earlier on, how he felt older people should be still allowed to have a few pints too. Would younger people, your friends, would they drink and drive?
No, we wouldn't
it's
be
like your dad is looking at you now, but you, I am just interested, I suppose, is there a temptation for people?
No, like the licence is hard enough, God, never mind losing over a few pints. So you're better off just getting the local link or your old pair to drop you.
John Cook reporting for Drive Time with Mary Wilson. Morning Ireland reporter Cian McCormack was also on the road this week, revisiting towns and communities he went to in 2013, trying to get a sense of what's changed since Ireland left the bailout 5 years ago. Peter Roach from Abenochmoy lost his son Colin to suicide before Christmas in 2010. When Cian spoke to him in 2013, he was still grieving hard. He said Christmas was marked by an empty space at the table. 5 years on, he's coping.
No family is ever prepared for the devastation that a loss of a child brings. Our son Colin was 22 years of age. He was brilliantly adjusted, you might say. Very bright, very talented. Everything going for him was in a lovely relationship. As I said, on the 29th of November, the most horrendous time weather-wise as well, because you might recall we had minus 15, minus 19 degrees. And snow compacted into the ground, and we had this awful experience. The very thought of snow or a freeze over anymore, really, I suppose it freezes my heart inside, because it just is such a cold reminder of what happened to us. And that still lives with us. You know, only a couple of weeks ago we had Colin's anniversary, and I have to say that it was as difficult a day as the days, you know, after he passed away. There is a void there to be spoken about. Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, I always feel, since Colin left us, it's extremely difficult to get over. It's Christmas, I've always felt, is a very sad time anyway. And listening to all of the Christmas music and, you know, and the Christmas hymns, and you go out shopping and everyone seems to be happy. And inside your heart is really aching. And then when Christmas passes over, it's like as if, you know, you're looking forward to the days getting longer. And we have managed our loss, I have to say, brilliantly, in my own opinion, because we are and have always spoken about the absence and about the loss. And I suppose the need for us as a family, when you're in that situation, to be able to support others by giving that encouragement and encouraging others that might be challenged to do the right thing, and that is to speak to someone that can offer them the kind of support that I suppose maybe all too many didn't seek and are no longer with us.
From Tuesday's Morning Ireland, and if you need that support, you can contact the Samaritans on free phone 116 123. That's free phone 116 123. Well, as you must know by now, this year marks 100 years since women were granted the right to vote and women first entered the political arena. And although a lot may have changed, the issue of gender balance continues to be a problem. While we've never had a woman as Taoiseach, Sean O'Rourke's guests on Wednesday, Frances Fitzgerald and Mary Coughlan, did make it up the greasy political pole to high office. Frances served as Taoiseach in both Enda Kenny and Leo Varadkar's administrations, while Mary Coughlin served as Taoiseach to Brian Cowan.
One of the extraordinary things, only 20 women have been in the Irish cabinet since Countess Markovitch, and there was a long period, half a century, from Countess Markovitch to Maura Gaegan Quinn.
When I look down at the Dáil, I sometimes think it's almost the same as when I first went in there. Now, what I mean by that is there are changes, you know, the secret election of the Cean Chomhairle, the increasing role of committees. But in terms of diversity, there's 78% men in the Dáil and there's 22% women. It's outrageous in terms of representation and it's absolutely an unfinished democracy. And, you know, we really have to look towards that. I was in a cabinet with three, at one stage, four women and then five women. I think, Mary, you were in a cabinet with three women, max.
I suppose you don't want to be seen to be harping on, but the facts are the facts and the facts are that we don't have enough representation. And certainly the tools by which we find ourselves where there's change need to be looked at. And one of the things I was vehemently against at the time were quotas, because I believe you should be there because you have the capacity to be there and to be elected. That being said, it's quite obvious that it's not necessarily working. There has been some change in the context of setting quotas for the parties.
For the number of candidates.
For the number of candidates that are running. At least if you have candidates, you have some opportunity of getting elected. But at local government level as well, it's not as good as it should be. And when it's not good at local government level, you often don't see it translating into people being elected to TDs.
I mean, they say that, you know, it's the cash, the confidence, the childcare, getting through conventions. And sometimes when you look at politics, you kind of think it hasn't changed enough. Civic society has changed. We've been very impacted by the changes. And, you know, the interaction, I would say, between NGOs, we've seen that in the 8th campaign and we've seen it in marriage equality. I think there's greater partnerships between the Dáil and other groups now. And I think that's been a really positive. Mm. The committees have opened up to the outside world more. But the actual business of politics, in many ways, you know, that adversarial nature, there's a big discussion going on. Are we moving to more consensus politics? In some ways we are, but when you look
doesn't always work either, because if you don't have the capacity to make a decision and to drive on, then you're going nowhere. You don't get any action.
You need decisions.
You need to have affirmative action when it comes to those decisions to be followed through. Because when you have too much, I'm a great believer in consensus, but if there's too much consensus, you have inertia and nothing happens.
That's true. Governments have to lead.
Frances Fitzgerald and Mary Coughlin heard on today with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. 6 years ago, a law was passed that made it illegal for Irish girls and women to be taken out of the country to be circumcised in a practice known as female genital mutilation, or FGM. But the reality is that up to 6,000 women and girls in Ireland have undergone this barbaric procedure. In last Saturday's documentary on One, The Cut, producer Michael O'Kane went in search of those living in Ireland who survived the procedure. He found hard-hitting testimony. And a word to the wise, this is not suitable for sensitive ears.
We're in Port Arrington, beautiful town, in my home. I live here with my two beautiful boys, Paul and Nathan, and we love it. It's very quiet.
This is Meherit Yemani Abdigergish. Like Ifra, she fled to Ireland in 2006, but from Eritrea via Sudan in East Africa, where the rate of FGM is over 90%.
The older I get, the more I'm finding out, like, how affected I am. Mine was done by a woman who was related to my sister's husband. It was done 4 times. The last two I remember, the first two I don't remember because I was very young, and it was done with my two sisters. And then the last one, I was between 9 and 10, and it was done with my youngest sister, actually the same time, you know. I don't know, the woman kept saying that, you know, the last time she didn't do a good job. You know, she left something, and my last one I remember very vividly.
Did you know it was going to happen? And
yes, I did, because they say, oh, you're going to get circumcised with your younger sister. I remember my brothers held me with my legs, and my mother was there. And the woman, she took this blade. She used the same blade for me and my sister, because we were there side by side. And then they let you go, but you have to leave your legs open for a few days. And you'll be outside in the bed they will wash you with salt and warm water as well, because to help with the process of healing, because there's no antibiotics and there was no anesthetic, you know. So what happened was she came early in the morning, because you're supposed to do it early before the sun comes out. Sorry.
And you can listen back to Michael O'Kane's documentary, The Cut. Go to rte.ie/doc on one or podcast the documentary on one. Architect Dermot Bannon has what's known as the likability factor in spades, always sunny and interesting. He was Ryan Tubridy's guest on Tuesday, and he's on the lookout for challenging projects for his makeover television series, Room to Improve.
You know, if you're a punter on Room to Improve, and yes, you get you involved,
a client, you mean?
Sorry, client.
I used to call them contestants.
You're like Donald Trump picking High Court and Supreme Court judges.
Yes,
here's the next contestant. It's going to be huge. When you have a client,
yes.
What does the client get for being on the program for free?
They get me for free.
So you're the free.
I'm the freebie.
Okay,
I'm the freebie. So it's really worth it, isn't it?
Well, it must be, because no, but they're very well cast. I think that's what's so important about Room to Improve.
Well, I suppose it is. It's not that it's getting harder every year, but I suppose it's we're trying to find projects every year that we haven't done before. Mm-hmm. So there has to be two things, I think, in a Room to Improve project. First of all, the people have to be good characters, and they have to be able to articulate how they feel. But that's not that difficult.
Yes.
But I think it has to be. For me, it's always been about the project. Like, I'll walk in somewhere and the producer's, don't like this. And I'll walk in and I'll see something. No, this is brilliant. So for me, there has to be a great project behind it. But it can be anything. Mm-hmm. It can be big. It can be small.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's like we did one last year and everybody thought, there's not much in this project. It's really just a garage conversion. But it was the graffiti wall one. I don't know if you remember that.
I saw them all. I loved
them. I loved that project. So sometimes it's the tiniest little projects can be the best and the most interesting.
Do you like the quirky ones?
I like the ones that are a challenge, that put me out beyond my comfort zone. Yeah. When people say, I can't see what you do here, they're the ones. Like, my favourite one of all time was a warehouse in Dunleary. We converted that into a house and everybody stood at what? Yeah. But that was because anything that kind of slightly challenges you and it was like Sudoku or something like that.
You know
when you get to the point, then you just have it solved.
That's a great feeling.
I get that feeling when I get a project like that you've worked at it and worked at it and worked at it. And sometimes the ones that you think are going to be really easy are the ones that you don't spend as much time at. Like when you get a really difficult project, I'll be working on it from the moment I see it. I'll be in the car and I'll be sketching. And then there's an easy one. And then suddenly you think, right, a couple of hours and I'll have that solved. And then you don't.
One of Dermot's most memorable clients was teenager Michael Stokes. He was only 15 when he died last May after a fall. Dermot had worked closely with Michael to transform his foster parents' home to suit his disability.
Our paths did cross for the saddest of reasons with Michael. Yeah. Michael Stokes. As the year draws to a close, he was just one of those extraordinary boys to have met. If they don't remember, there was that famous programme you made, and then we invited Michael on with Anne and Barry and to tell the story as his foster parents, and it just was working out so beautifully for them as a blended modern family that they could bring him into their home. You renovated their house. He was so proud. I remember sadly saw his body in that bed and in that room that you created, because those lovely people were mourning this boy. That was their world.
Yeah.
Tell me about him and you and your association and how it all felt for you in your head and your heart.
God, thinking back, it was a very normal project, because the first time I met Anne and Barry, obviously they were describing Michael and I kind of, it became a project about disability, but I hadn't met Michael at this stage. Within 5 minutes of meeting Michael, he just completely disarmed you. And
he was a rock star.
Yeah, and he had this amazing charisma and he had this amazing personality. And it became a project about Anne, Barry and Michael, not Anne and Barry creating a house for somebody who had a disability. Mm-hmm. It was an incredible project to work on. It's one that people still talk to me about. I'm just devastated for them. Like, I really am. I think about them every single day.
Do you?
I can't look at a picture of Michael yet. It's horrendous. Like, and I'm very thankful that I got to meet him.
Yeah.
I'm very thankful that I knew him, because he put a lot of perspective into my life at the time.
Did he really? I mean, did you kind of think, good luck? Because you're a dad of kids. I think that changes things and perception and perspective. What do you mean by that, by perspective?
Well, just, we were going to, my mum, my, we were going through stuff at home in with an illness, and you know, we were struggling with that, and it put shape onto it, and just said, you know something, Michael, no matter, like when you saw sometimes in the chair and the difficulty he had getting into the car and the difficulty he had in doing regular things, and how he did it, and he sang, and he did it with joy. The littlest things in life made him so happy, and he embraced them, and that taught me a huge amount, just to forget this, don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah.
Architect Dermot Bannon with Ryan Tuberty on Tuesday. This weekend, the James Stephens Barracks in Kilkenny will host a unique Yule Fest event where they'll reenact the Christmas truce that happened in 1914 during the First World War. The funds raised will go to the Good Shepherd charity, which supports homeless people to get back on their feet. Well, Joe is one of those men, and he spoke with Evelyn O'Rourke yesterday.
Well, I wasn't a great person when I was out there hauling up a jug or a piece of cardboard, you know, just to throw pennies into a pot like to
and
get.
And you did that?
Oh, yeah, I did, yeah.
What's that like?
Oh, humiliating. That's all I could put it. Like, I used to have my head down in a cap and just hauling the cup up. And I remember there one day a person put €5 in it and I thought I was a millionaire. You know, that'll get me two cups of coffee now if I spend it in McDonald's. And that's how narrow-minded my thinking got. And
that's how small your world got.
That's how small my world got. It was just to survive at that time. And I mean, my hygiene wasn't the best either. And I went into Castle Park one day into the thing and I washed.
So you went into the bathrooms in there to wash?
No. I went into the pond and I washed myself. And they have a pond down the back of it as well. And I washed myself down there. I always made sure I went in early mornings, but there'd be very little people around, you know. Sometimes you find somewhere to sleep, you know, you just light a fire, you gather enough just to light a fire, just to keep you warm for 2 or 3 hours at that time. And if you manage to fall asleep, well and good. Most of the time I didn't. But being homeless is the most horrendous thing that anyone can feel. It's the ultimate humiliation. But I rebuilt my confidence in the Good Shepherd. You know, everything is working itself out slowly. And I'm in college today. For me, my home is my personal space now. It's mine for life. It's nice to breathe air. It's not the same air as when you're breathing when you're homeless or when you're in a hostel. The Good Shepherd caters for all. They've helped me find me again.
Evelyn O'Rourke reporting for the Today Show yesterday. I was listening to John Bowman's programme last Sunday morning, which is always dripping with pure radio gold, and he featured an interview with the late David Green on the beauty of hurling. And in the week of Mullinjachta's spectacular win on the football field and their coach invoking the spirit of Setanta and Fionn McCool, I thought even non-sports fans would enjoy this one.
And it seems to me that hurling has what is necessary, of course, skill, skills which are so instinctive that they require a lifetime to learn. This is an important thing. This pleases the spectator when he sees these skills being demonstrated, and at the same time, a reasonable amount of toughness. I think these two things together make hurling the best game played on your feet that I know. I say played on your feet because I'm very fond, and I enjoyed this immensely in the States, I'm very fond of ice hockey, in which skates are interposed between your feet and the ground. And ice hockey, of course, has exactly the same ingredients. This extraordinary skill, which again has to be learned, obviously, from the very moment a child gets on the ice, and at the same time, a good deal of physical contact. So this makes hurling, I can advocate hurling, simply as the best game I know. That is inside my terms of reference. And the other thing, of course, which is also another aspect of it, as well as being a ball game buff, as the Americans would say, I am also, of course, deeply interested in our historic culture. And there's very little of our historic culture left, except the Irish language and hurling. By a curious accident, as you will know, Sean, they don't flourish in the same places where hurling flourishes, the language doesn't, and vice versa. But nevertheless, I personally find it impossible ever to look at a good game without remembering that this has been going on for thousands of years in this country. Not, of course, in the exact form of the GAA rules, which we know are fairly recent, but nevertheless, that this particular demonstration of ancient skills isn't a thing of yesterday or the day before, but goes back as far as we know anything about the history of the Irish people. That makes it certainly the best ball game to look at for me.
The late Professor David Green, heard on Bowman Sunday 8:30. But I leave you now with a song from Ham Sandwich, who played live on the Ray D'Arcy show on Tuesday. Gramahaga Vasor Golder, Tasulam Gurwanchiv Saltasaglor, Agus Gemeshiv Lum Taka Namakena, and Sachtan Chogin, Kajishin, Kajeshiv Slan.
Trees.